Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm really excited to have with me today a really fantastic guest all the way from Denmark, who is really just a world expert on hyperoxia, and listeners will know it is a topic near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about two recent studies, articles that Dr. Mayhoff published, and in fact, that is my guest, Christian Mayhoff, who, as many of you will know, is just a prolific researcher when it comes to many things, including hyperoxia. He's the head of research and an associate research professor in the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care in Copenhagen University Hospital in Copenhagen, Denmark, and he's coming to us all the way from there. Really exciting to have him. As I said, he's got two trials. One, the VIXI trial that was published in Anesthesiology recently that looked at, and we'll talk about the details, but that looked at hyperoxia in the operating room. And then a second coming out, or that just recently came out in ANA, that looked at some data retrospectively. And we'll talk about how the findings of those two articles are actually quite different. Quickly, before we jump in, remember, you can get CME if you need it by going to ACRAC.com and clicking on the link in the show notes. That fantastic CME opportunity is provided by CMEify, so go check it out if you need some CME. And now, Dr. Christian Mayhoff, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jed. Thank you very much for being a part of the show. I really look forward to it. And I'm happy you also see oxygen use in anesthesia and intensive care as an important aspect of your interest. I definitely share that, and I've been working for that for the last 15 years or more.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for the work you've done and that you continue to do. Let's start just with you. Tell the audience a little about you. As you said, you know, what you do now, what your day to day is, and how you got where you are.
Thank you. Yeah. So today I'm head of research at the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care at Bispebjerg Hospital, that's the general hospital for the Copenhagen area. And apart from my research time, which is always full time plus more, then I do on calls and work daily at both the operation room and in the ICU. So the Danish way of being an anesthesiology specialist is actually both taking care of the ICU patient as well as doing anesthesia in the OR. So we have a lot of emergency medical conditions and a lot of patients with cardiopulmonary conditions undergoing rather large surgery, and that's why I find it very important to care for these patients and reduce the frequency of cardiac and pulmonary complications.
Fantastic. And, you know, just out of curiosity, let me ask you, is it true that in a lot of Europe and potentially in Denmark too, are all anesthesiologists basically also do intensive care? It's kind of one in the same, or do you do a separate training for intensive care, or it's just all part of the same training?
The specialty is combined, and during specialty training, you go to both the OR and the ICU. So I find that as a great advantage, because some of the intensive care treatment of patients and improving their organ function, that is very relevant being in the OR for difficult cases to optimize the patient and care for them. And also, likewise, being specialist in general anesthesia, some advances in the ICU. So that's all. And then, of course, after specialty training, that we will subspecialize in each subspecialty. But we have the same conference in the morning and share on calls.
Okay, so there is additional, like a fellowship in critical care for those who want to really specialize in it.
Okay.
And are the ICUs in Denmark mostly staffed with anesthesiologists, or are there also, you know, medical trained, like pulmonary critical care through a medicine residency. Do they work in ICUs there as well?
The ICUs are, in fact, a little different from the North American way of having ICUs. So they're staffed only by specialists in anesthesiology and intensive care medicine. We, of course, have consultants from other specialties looking after their patients whenever we call for them. The nursing staff are also specialty trained for intensive care. So so it's a good cross-sectoral collaboration. Also, patients in the ICU are quite more sick because ICU beds are very expensive, and being a public healthcare system, then it's being cut down. So, for example, at my hospital, we have 12 ICU beds, which is a fairly large intensive care unit in a Danish setting.
Great. So what got you interested in hyperoxia specifically? And you've clearly done some trials in the past and now have this new VIXI trial out. What led you to decide to spend a lot of your research time and focus on this topic?
But thanks. It's really a great question because I'm really fascinated by the academic dilemma. Is this intervention that we give to all of our patients, is it really beneficial, or is it in fact harmful, but we cannot really recognize when harms occur? So when I first heard of the two first perioperative trials of high oxygen concentration versus normal oxygen concentration, which was published in 2000 and 2004 by Greif and Pryor, these trials showed fundamentally different results. First trial, which I think was a great trial, which really put the research on the international agenda, showed that the frequency of postoperative surgical site infection could be cut by 50% by increasing the FiO2 to 0.80 versus 0.30. That was then followed by the prior trial showing a doubled surgical site infection risk in the 80% group, which was really shocking to the community, and that got me fascinated right away.
I mean, how often does that happen, right? That just a few years apart, you have not just slightly differing results, but like as far apart as you could get, right? I mean, one showing a protection and one showing a vast harm. It's so interesting. And I think so illustrative of this particular issue where the data is kind of all over the map, but I can see how that would get you interested. And so let's talk about the VIXI trial specifically. What led you to say, okay, I want to ask this specific question in this population?
Yeah, so the last couple of years, I've been more and more interested in postoperative myocardial injury. And I've been so fortunate to participate in large global studies, such as the POIST-2 trial, POIST-3 trial, that investigated postoperative myocardial injury as assessed by routine postoperative troponin surveillance. And by measuring troponins, you identify not only the symptomatic cases of myocardial infarction, but you also detect a very large amount of prognostically relevant cases of myocardial injury, other being myocardial infarction that are in fact asymptomatic because the pain is having the patient is having pain elsewhere or being deprived by opioids or having an epidural anesthesia taking away chest pain, and also cases of myocardial injury, which is troponin elevations, that has no other extracardial cause than being a damage to the heart. And the numbers, as illustrated by some of the previous work from primarily the Population Health Research Institute in Canada, shows that a case of myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery is in fact associated with a significant increase of 30-day mortality. That got me fascinated because the intervention of oxygen, opposed to what most anesthesiologists expect, they would expect that the oxygen supply to the heart increases. But in fact, oxygen has some effects that may be harmful to the heart, such as coronary vasoconstriction and reduction of coronary artery blood flow.
Yeah, I just find that fascinating. And I think you're exactly on to a key point here, which is that most people, for good reason, think, and even doctors, as you say, think that giving supplemental oxygen will, you know, it's as clear as day. You give supplemental oxygen, that will obviously give more oxygen to the heart, the brain, and everything else. But that, because it seems like it should, you put more in, it should get there. But that's so key, right, is that through the free radical, interactions with nitric oxide, you actually end up with vasoconstriction and deliver less. You, even if you get a little bit more oxygen in the blood, you deliver less oxygen to the tissue. And so that's why, for example, the AVOID trial, right, showed, or at least we think that's why the AVOID trial showed worse outcomes in patients with STEMI who got oxygen, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a great controversy of that. And what also was a trigger for my interest in looking at myocardial injury in response to oxygen fraction during general anesthesia was that actually during my PhD thesis, I conducted a Danish national trial of oxygen and the frequency of postoperative surgical site infection. And that trial, the proxy trial, which was published in 2009, actually showed no difference in surgical site infection. But within 30 days, we looked at sort of the 30-day mortality data and considered, well, why not do a long-term follow-up of mortality after these patients that underwent the major abdominal surgery? These were all laparotomy patients, 1,400 patients undergoing laparotomy surgery. And in fact, the long-term follow-up study found a significantly increased risk of mortality at the follow-up time of 2.5 years after surgery. That sort of triggered our minds to look at the different organ systems in which we affect during surgery. Could it really be true that the oxygen intervention effect, which was given during surgery and for 2 hours after surgery, that combined up to 5 hours in total, could these few hours, 5 hours with excess oxygen administration, could it really affect the patient on the long term? And then we looked at different risks that could be collected in the Danish National Patient Registers. We have a very, very thorough follow-up in the Danish Kingdom of the National Patient ID, in which we can allocate all outcomes occurring in the US after surgery. So we follow up on the frequency of myocardial infarction. And although the number of events were luckily very, very few, there was in fact a significantly increased number of myocardial infarction patients given 80% oxygen. But as you know, did a post hoc observational study that was not pre-planned. It was conducted many years after very few events. We couldn't really conclude with any great certainty about the benefit or harm with the oxygen on the myocardium. That was why we conducted the LEAPS trial.
Yeah. And so, you know, I want to just clarify for listeners, because we've talked about a few different things. The original thought, right, that you mentioned, those initial kind of 2004 trial looked at surgical site infection. And even though the World Health Organization still, I think, has a recommendation, or now it's been downgraded from recommendation to, suggestion. But I think they still have a suggestion that it's better to use 80% oxygen to prevent surgical site infection. But I think that's been pretty debunked, right? I think the understanding is that's probably not actually well supported by the evidence that that higher levels of oxygen do reduce surgical site infection. Is that fair to say?
That's better to say, in my opinion, and I share that view with many other research groups around the globe. It's very difficult to provide guidelines for one benefit if the power to exclude detrimental side effects is so reduced as it is. So in order to see the difficulty in providing such guidelines from the WHO, and I think the CDC has in fact adopted that guideline, which is now a suggestion, the power to see cases and speak about a difference for surgical site infection, that's much more increased, because after major surgery, the frequency of surgical site infection is approximately 20%. And both trials have focused on that, so the power to really see a difference is much increased. However, the potential harms with high oxygen concentrations being respiratory failure, myocardial infarctions, stroke, they occur so rarely that much more data is needed to really exclude a difference and provide a statement that it is really safe to give extra oxygen.
Right. Okay. So we've kind of moved on in a way from thinking about or looking at trials of surgical site infection to looking at the potential negative effects, like you just said, the effects on the heart. As we talked about the AVOID trial, and others have looked at the risk of additional damage in a heart that's already been damaged, so patients with STEMI, and there's some mixed data on that. And what you're trying to look at in the VIXI trial is intraoperatively. Is there a risk? And these are patients, we should say, who are not just kind of healthy baseline patients, right? These were patients with risk factors for cardiac disease going in for non-cardiac surgery, right?
Right. So in the VIXI trial, we included 600 patients, and they were aged 45 years or greater. They all had a major cardiovascular risk factor or a couple of minor risk factors.
Right. So give some examples of what those risk factors were in these patients.
Yeah, it can be a 50-year-old smoker that also has diabetes, and it could be a 70-year-old male with a stroke.
Great.
Basically, those patients that we want to take extra good care of.
Right. And so you would think, and your hypothesis was that these patients with risk factors for coronary disease who got higher levels of oxygen intraoperatively would do worse. And there's, you know, again, there's good reason to think that we talked about the vasoconstriction, et cetera, that if they're delivering less oxygen to the heart, delivering less blood, they may or should do worse. But what did you find?
Yeah, so basically, the quick conclusion is that there was no difference. And I can add a few words to that. So, of course, having a trial with our available funding that provided us the opportunity to recruit 600 patients. We estimated an outcome of myocardial injury after surgery with troponin measurements. And the troponin measurements, we used the fifth generation, the high-sensitive troponin T assay. And with that, we measured troponin before surgery, and then on the first, second, and third postoperative day, if patients were still hospitalized at that time. And in order to provide a really sensitive outcome of what is the extent of myocardial injury, we then calculated the area under the curve of the troponin concentrations during these days, which was in fact the same procedure as that was done in the AVOID trial you mentioned of STEMI patients. So we had a very sensitive measurement of what was the extent of myocardial injury in these patients. And actually, in the two oxygen groups, one giving 80% oxygen during surgery and for 2 hours after surgery, that was 35 nanograms per liter per day for troponin T, and it was in fact exactly the same concentration for the area under the curve group in the 30% oxygen group, also 35 nanograms per liter. That actually gives two very important conclusions from the VIXI trial. First, the extent of myocardial injury, the average area under the curve for myocardial injury, 35 nanograms per liter per day, that is not a lot. So basically, these patients did pretty well. Of course, there was a high frequency of myocardial injury, but to the general extent, the magnitude of myocardial injury was not that high. So our overall frequency of myocardial injury was 23%, but the rest of the patients, they did fine. Another important conclusion is that looking at the median difference between the two groups, we can actually exclude, because the trial was really well-powered, we have a lot of patients and a lot of measurements, we can actually exclude that there is an opportunity for a large difference in myocardial injury. So that's really important. That adds to the safety, in fact, of increasing oxygen during general surgery. So the extent where we can exclude that a major impact on the myocardial injury.
Right. And as we said, this is different than what you expected, certainly different than what I would have expected. So why do you think it didn't matter to these patients that they had presumably less oxygen delivery to the heart, but didn't therefore have more, injury to the heart or more or poor worse outcomes afterwards? Why didn't this come out the way we thought it would?
I think it's an excellent question. And even though we take that as the last question and do all the podcast about why couldn't we detect any difference, we cannot say it with certainty. We can give some estimates. My best estimate will actually be that oxygen may not be that harmful or that beneficial as we thought. I mean, it's a very intriguing thought that oxygen changes so many things in the body when we do anesthesia and when we admit patients to ICU, but maybe the effect is less than we believe. There may be some effects. It's very well documented that by increasing oxygen, you increase the systemic vascular resistance, you increase the coronary artery resistance, but such a change may not be as powerful as we thought. Another way of explaining it is that, in fact, we change something and maybe it's harmful. Maybe oxygen provoke some pathophysiological changes that are in fact harmful. But then having a complication after surgery, that's a result of so many interventions, hundreds of different things and therapies that may or may not be beneficial. So another explanation is that the effect of oxygen, even if it is slightly harmful, then it could be moderated by other good interventions and then resulting in no difference between groups. But I think also the individual treatment of each patient contributes to the outcome of the surgery.
Yeah, all really interesting. I have a couple questions. So do you think there's any chance that the anesthesia itself counteracted the effect of the oxygen? So the vasodilation from the anesthesia could have counteracted the vasoconstriction from the higher oxygen and that kind of canceled it out. Is that possible?
That's a likely explanation as well. That in fact, the vascular tone in the different organs that we care for during anesthesia, it's not very well described. So what is, in fact, the perfusion at the surgical site? What is the myocardial perfusion in all cases? What is the myocardial perfusion below significant stenosis in some of the coronary arteries? I mean, there are a lot of questions that we do not know. How they behave during anesthesia. So we do the best we can. We strive to maintain normal physiology, And perhaps the effect of anesthesia on the vertebrate greatly increased vasodilatation, the counteraction of a slightly vasoconstriction with oxygen, that may be a very minor effect compared to what we do during anesthesia.
Right, right. Interesting. So that's a possibility. The other thing, I think this is less likely, is that, you know, maybe any supplemental oxygen is harmful, and that even 30%, which is still super physiologic, was bad enough that 80%, you know what I mean? I think it's unlikely, because it seems like, why would 30% and 80% be the same? But, you know, I would probably be very hard to do a trial of 21% versus 80%, but that would be interesting, right? Would be to know if it's that, you know, there's something about supplemental oxygen in general that's harmful, and that the amount may be less important. I think, again, that strikes me as less likely, but it could be.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks. Pattern is a disability insurance company, and they know that you want to be confident and in control of your finances. In order to do that, you need to buy disability insurance. Pattern understands the problem is that researching insurance is complicated and time-consuming, which can make you feel overwhelmed and unsure of who to trust. Pattern knows that your time is valuable, and they believe that doctors have more important things to do than worry about insurance. That's why thousands of doctors have trusted Pattern to help them understand the insurance they're buying. Here's how they do it. You go in, you request your quotes, you compare your options, and you buy risk-free. So request your quotes today at patternlife.com. That's PATTERNLIFE.com. So you can stop wasting time and feeling overwhelmed, and instead save money and spend time on the things you love, being confident your family and income are protected. And we're back to hear whether Dr. Mayhoff thinks just a little bit of supplemental oxygen may cause as much harm as a lot of supplemental oxygen.
I like that hypothesis as well, because, we shouldn't, although we care for the most important period during a surgical treatment, at least in our own minds, then we must also recognize that it's not only the maintenance oxygen concentration during surgery that is the exposure. A lot of oxygen therapies that goes on for even the 80% oxygen group and the 30% oxygen group, that is similar in all trials. And all trials have actually used pre-oxygenation with 100% oxygen, which I firmly believe is the correct way to do pre-oxygenation. And most trials, including the VIXI trial, use post-oxygenation with 80% oxygen for both groups. Then there is the transport between the OR and the PACU, different to discriminate with oxygen concentrations there. Of course, the intervention continues in the PACU, but then after PACU, there may be also exposures to oxygen in the general wards, which we, at least in the VIXI trial, we hadn't counted for that. That may be quite a lot of oxygen given, although at lower FiO2s, but it's for a very prolonged time, not hours, but several days.
Right. Yeah, so interesting. I mean, because when you look at the AVOID trial, you know, and other trials that have looked at, for example, patients coming into the emergency room with STEMI, they're A, not under anesthesia, right? They're awake. And B, they're not getting 100% oxygen, because we're talking about a nasal cannula, right? They're getting maybe 30%. So it is interesting to wonder if, you know, there's something different about being under anesthesia. There's something different about a small amount of oxygen versus a large amount. All this is really interesting stuff. You mentioned intubation, so pre-oxygenation, and people ask me that too. And I always say the same thing, which is that I think the benefits of having a longer time to get that breathing tube in are probably outweigh any risk from you know, 2 minutes of high levels of oxygen, though we don't know that, but it seems like it makes sense. The other question people ask is extubation. So in general, I guess I have two questions. And first, let's start with the VIXI trial. Were the patients in the 30% group extubated on 30% oxygen, or was it turned up for extubation?
That was increased before extubation to 80% oxygen in both groups. And that is what we consider the most safe way of extubating patients. to also give an increased apnea time after extubation.
And I think this is a fascinating point too, because I would say that in my experience, almost all practitioners that I've ever observed extubate on 100% oxygen. And I don't. I like to extubate on about 80%, like you said. And the argument there is that having some nitrogen in there will prevent absorption atelectasis, or at least help attenuate it. Is that also your practice?
Totally, yeah. And I fully agree. I mean, the reason why I would recommend pre-oxygenation with 100% oxygen, that's because we know that that results in resorption atelectasis. Resorption atelectasis is also greater with 100% oxygen than 80% oxygen. However, all these atelectases, they will and can be counteracted during general anesthesia of the positive pressure ventilation. If we just add a little deep or do some ventilation after endotracheal intubation, it will go away or at least be normalized. But after extubation, it requires a more active patient to remove absorption atelectasis. And we do not, at least not in Denmark, we do not routinely provide CPAP to all patients in the PACU. So that requires a patient being really awake and being able to eliminate the atelectasis themselves.
Yeah, I completely agree. That makes a ton of sense to me. So the final piece is that let's just assume for a second, and this may not be true, but let's say that your trial suggests that people who have risk factors for cardiac disease, it doesn't seem to matter whether they get higher levels of oxygen or not intraoperatively. But maybe somebody who actually has an intraoperative MI, which is really rare, right? So, you know, clearly not something that would be easy to study, but someone who actually has a STEMI, not a cardiac injury, but I'm talking about a ST elevation MI intraoperatively, maybe they would do worse with higher levels of oxygen, but that would be very hard to know, right? When you look at people coming into the emergency department with STEMI, we think they probably do worse with higher levels of oxygen. But when you're looking intraoperatively, it's really hard to look at people having intraoperative STEMIs, right? It's just you need an enormous number of patients to do that trial. So it's possible that even if for kind of all comers, it doesn't matter, maybe for someone who is actually going to have a STEMI, it might matter. Does that seem reasonable?
I think it's a very interesting thing to more research. And the intriguing part is also to recognize when does a myocardial infection actually occur during or after surgery? So the numbers are actually rather high during non-cardiac surgery because so many of the cases of myocardial infections are asymptomatic. So I would believe that it's not that rare that a case of myocardial infection starts during surgery. However, our way of diagnosing it is very limited. So it could be a hypothesis that these patients could do worse with the high concentration in oxygen during surgery. But on the other hand, we must also recognize that this is a really good indication for increasing the oxygen fraction because it also promotes some other effects during anesthesia, such as the risk of lung injury, which may or may not be a concern as well. So I think the routine use of high oxygen concentration is not really warranted.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. So you also recently had another article come out. You looked at the VISION study data. Tell us a little bit about that. What led you to do that, and what did you look at specifically?
Yeah. So this was an international collaboration, which we were very happy to conduct and analyze data from the VISION study, which was actually the study that led to the definition now of myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery, the MINS diagnosis. So the VISION trial was a prospective cohort study measuring troponin after surgery in all patients aged 45 or greater having surgery with an overnight hospital stay. So an unselected cohort of patients having troponin measurements at many, many sites in all parts of the world. And we, together with collaborators in Canada, US, Hong Kong, Colombia, South Africa, Malaysia, we contacted the sites and we were able to obtain intraoperative FiO2 beta from approximately 6,500 patients. That provided a very interesting association between what we then calculated as the median FiO2 during surgery and then the occurrence of MINS after surgery. So MINS was reported on all patients, and we could then calculate an association with the median FiO2 to MINS.
So you looked at essentially oxygen, median oxygen exposure with myocardial injury, and what did you find?
Yeah, so I must say this really puzzled our mind because the analysis, they were being performed while we conducted the Dixit trial, and the publication now states that in the Vision study, we could see with high power that each 10% increase in intraoperative oxygen concentration, it is a 0.10 increase in FiO2, that was associated with an increase in the odds of MINS of 1.17. That was a statistically significant increase. So MINS was occurring in higher frequencies and also linearly correlated to the intraoperative FiO2, the highest occurrence of MINS being in the patients having the highest oxygen concentration during surgery.
So this is, of course, in direct contradiction to what you found in the VIXI study. So how do you put that together?
Yeah, of course, it's important to recognize that the VISION study analysis of oxygen exposure and MINS, that's observational data. And the VIXI trial, that's a randomized controlled trial. And we know from the hierarchy of evidence that randomized controlled trials has the highest level of evidence. And the reason is that it accounts for unobserved confounding. And of course, we know as our general anesthesia practice that we may tend to increase the intraoperative FiO2 if patient is already having a complication during surgery. And that was not for all patients recorded intraoperative events in the VISION study. That may be an important confounder in the analysis. On the other hand, the intraoperative hemodynamic in the VISION study, that seemed to be the same in patients across all different FiO2s.
Interesting. So, as you said, when we compare randomized control trial to observational data, you know, clearly the randomized control trial is a higher level of evidence. And so what do you think some of the confounders might have been? One obviously would be in the observational data that sicker patients were getting higher levels of oxygen. That sort of seems like a very obvious one. You're concerned about a patient. They're not doing well intraoperatively. Even if the hemodynamics don't seem affected, it may be that, you know, the physician was worried about something, the anesthesiologist was worried about something, and so, you know, adjusted the FiO2 higher, or even just that in general, they felt like they were sicker from the get-go and so said, I'm going to run a higher level of oxygen. Does that seem like the most likely confounder, or are there others?
I think it's definitely the most important confounder to discuss and take into account. Of course, we adjusted our findings and the odds ratio. I mentioned it adjusted for all measured confounders, being all comorbidity and pre-operative risk factors. But unmeasured confounding, that clearly is the most important. Another explanation I must emphasize is that we also look at the different study sites in the vision study, and we actually we could not avoid seeing a rather clear difference in intervention effect across study sites. So that actually indicates, in my opinion, that there may be some conditions, as you also mentioned, Jed, that the way we treat patients at different hospitals, different healthcare systems, that may impact how much oxygen may or may not be harmful, how much oxygen may or may not be beneficial. Just going back to the situation with the surgical site infection, the way oxygen is believed to influence surgical site infection positively is through the bacterial killing by neutrophils, and that requires oxygen dissolved in blood to actually go to the surgical site. And I believe that the perfusion of the surgical site, that may vary rather greatly across different hospital systems, different hospitals, of course, also at a patient level, but the variability in the way we treat patients, that may affect how we see interventions work. For example, the way we control vasopressors and the way we control the volume therapy and blood management, that is also subject to great controversy. Do we keep a very restrictive preoperative care, or are we more liberal with fluids, for example? So there may be some hospital settings or site settings that impact the outcome as well. And I know that these two trials we've conducted here, it will not be the last trials about oxygen, and definitely some more to be done.
Yeah, so interesting. I love that you pointed that out, the difference in sites. And you could imagine, for example, one thing that comes to mind would be if one site preferentially used phenylephrine as a pressor, where another used norepinephrine, you could easily imagine the decreased perfusion from phenylephrine would maybe affect the how the concentration of oxygen would play a role compared to the norepinephrine, which can increase cardiac output and potentially, depending on, of course, the dose, increase perfusion. You may actually have a difference in perfusion to that surgical site, and that could lead to a difference in surgical site infection. And the same could be true for the heart, right? An increase in cardiac output versus a decrease in cardiac output could affect the delivery of oxygen to the heart. And that's separate, but could interact with the FiO2. So that is, I think, really, really interesting to think about.
Exactly. I totally agree. And that's what I think is really interesting for us being anesthesiologists, to really interact between the clinical care and observations in the OR and then the research setting in which we can strive to clarify these questions. And I think with the great amount of research being done about oxygen therapy during surgery, I think it's a highly needed approach to really clarify the benefit and harms of interventions we perform every day. And in fact, just looking at it sort of from an opposite angle, what if we actually introduced oxygen as a new medical drug? What would be the requirements to, in fact, give oxygen to patients, give supplemental oxygen to patients? What would the FDA or the EMEA in Europe, what would they really require of trials in order to approve this new drug? At least for clinical research in Denmark and EU, oxygen is considered a pharmaceutical drug, so we have very thorough monitoring of our trials, which is good in many ways. But really to document that this is safe, I mean, there would be a concern about vasoconstriction, I mean, the number of trials we would need to prove that this vasoconstriction is not really a matter we should have concerns about, that would be a lot, and it would require a lot of patients. And I mean, with this trial, also some great trials performed in the US, other countries, we've come a long way. But in my opinion, I mean, there may still be additional documentation that this intervention given every day is not harmful.
I agree completely. So, you know, there's, as we've discussed, there's just so much mixed data. There's the AVOID trial, which we talked about, showing worse outcomes in STEMI, but then the detox sweetheart trial, which didn't. There's the IOTA meta-analysis, which showed significantly worse outcomes with increasing levels of FiO2 in the hospital. There's the vision study data, which you said, you know, which you talked about, which also showed a correlation there. And then there's studies like your VIXI trial, which showed no difference. And there's some differences between all of these. Obviously, like we talked about, some are awake patients in the emergency department. Some are like the VIXI trial, patients in the operating room. So we talked about some of the reasons why this data might differ. And then your very interesting proposals that maybe the sites, the other practices happening at those sites may also affect what happens. And of course, different trials have different sites. Are there any other factors you think may be playing a role here in terms of why the data is all over the map?
One important future implication is the way we monitor patients after we discharge them from ICU or from the PACU, because the duration of hospital stay and where the complications occur, it's in fact not that common in our hands. It's more often in the surgical wards. And the way we do monitoring today is manual with several hours in between. And we can see all around the globe the number of wearables that's coming. And we will expect in the next years to see much more monitoring also of oxygen saturation. And I think it's very important to carefully evaluate that monitoring and look at what is really important. How do we detect complications after surgery? Can we use wearables in an advanced way to detect complications earlier and also treat them better? I mean, the way we follow patients after surgery, we may or may not detect deviations of upcoming complications, and the amount of care we give in to prevent complications or prevent the severity, reduce the severity of complications occurring after surgery, I think that will impact not only patient outcomes, but also how much harm we see from each intervention. One great example is the intervention with the preoperative initiation of beta blockers to prevent MI. That was actually effective for preventing MI, but it increased mortality due to uncontrolled hypotension. And in future hospital settings, we may be able to control hypotension, and then there will be other risk-benefit ratios of the interventions we already know and have an opinion about is this harmful or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting. And, you know, the other thing is that some of these, I mean, in the ICU, right? So we have the ICU ROCKS trial and the LOCO2 trial, which showed no difference. But, you know, these were really looking at kind of low versus, you know, either kind of almost hypoxia versus, you know, normoxia or low hyperoxia. And so it's not clear that 100% oxygen versus 25% oxygen would be the same. So I think just thinking about how the trials are conducted, thinking about, like you said, what we can monitor and what we can control. I love that example of the, the beta blockers and how I this comes up because people will say to me, I'll tell my residents, I often use esmolol with induction instead of fentanyl. And sometimes they'll say, wait a minute, but I thought it wasn't good to give a beta blocker, to a beta blocker naive patient on the day of surgery.
And I'll say, you know, yeah, if we were going to give them a massive dose of metoprolol and send them to the floor where they're going to have their vitals checked every 4 hours, that might be true. Yeah. But we can give Esmolol in the operating room where we're checking their vitals every second. And we can be pretty confident that if they get hypotensive, we can deal with that. So it's a very different scenario.
Yeah, interesting. I totally agree.
Well, fantastic. Anything else, Christian, that you think we should keep in mind for future studies that are either already underway or that you'd like to see done either by you or by anybody else?
I think a focus on actually combining cardiac and pulmonary outcomes in the same trial would be important. I think many of our interventions overlap in effects of not only on the cardiac or the vascular system, but also on the pulmonary system. That may be the case for oxygen, but also other trials such as flu trials. I think it impacts both systems. And I think intervention would be interesting to follow for both outcomes at the same time. And of course, I find it fascinating how much we can monitor after PACU. So I think our specialty may or may not voluntarily, but at some time we must, as anesthesiologists, also look outside our own department and collaborate with the surgical colleagues on how to monitor patients better.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something that you'd like to share with the audience that you think they should check out?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. First, I would actually recommend that you just give FiO2.21 to your next patient. Maintain that during surgery. You'll find a lot of very educational experience in ventilatory settings, PEEP, body positioning, respiratory physiology, etc. But yeah, so for the time off, I would actually recommend a Danish TV series that I believe is upcoming on Netflix, and it's called Borgen. That's Danish for the castle. So Borgen.
How do you spell it? Yeah, how do you spell the name?
Borgen.
Okay, and it means the castle.
It means the castle. And the castle is the Danish governmental building. And it's actually a political drama series. The reason why I'm mentioning it is that the fourth season is running now. And it has a very interesting view, actually, of the Arctic area with the story of a great oil finding occurring in Greenland. And who should really care about that? Should that be belonging to Greenland, or should it be belonging to Denmark, or should it be belonging to the US, or what about investors from Russia or China? So it's a greatly relevant drama in these years. And I would recommend seeing this fourth season. I think it will occur later this spring on Netflix. It's being sent in Denmark at the moment. It is in fact so popular that the main character in the series is a female political leader. And he is now so famous in Denmark, the character, that most believe that she was in fact the first female prime minister of Denmark.
Wow, that's fantastic. Definitely sounds like something good to check out. Thank you. And I will recommend to folks a book that I read recently that was really fascinating. It's called When We Cease to Understand the World. It's by Benjamin Labatut. I may be pronouncing that wrong, but it's Labatut is the author. And it's really interesting. It's a fictional portrait, but of real mathematicians and physicists and their true, real discoveries and that led them really to kind of the brink of madness and insanity. And some of the story, you know, is fictional in that he's hypothesizing what they may have experienced or thought, but the discoveries and the kind of controversies around the mathematics and the physics that they discovered. So these are people like Heisenberg, for example, and the story of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and how kind of really just that came to be, and how crazy it was to think at the time of those kind of physics and the beginning of quantum mechanics and quantum physics. And it really drove some people crazy, because the people who were able to understand this could see it to an extent that it seemed kind of incomprehensible and almost madness producing. So it's really well written. It's very, very interesting. And I highly recommend people check it out. Christian, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic, and I know people will really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'm very happy to have been part of it. It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook, we are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Ryan Okonski is our social media manager. And Dr. April Liu is our production assistant. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.